I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm your host, Joe Perez, one of several lore-focused folks from Blizzard Watch, and I've got my barbarous co-host with me today, Matt Rossi. How are you doing today, Matt?
Were you Australian for a second there?
Sure, why not?
And I've got my friend Matt. What happened?
I don't know. It's kind of like how you turn into a miner randomly on the regular show.
No, I don't turn into a miner. I turn into a Russian who is then Scottish, or I turn into a cowboy. Both of those things happen. But y'all. Why am I saying y'all? There's no reason for this.
Well, in the spirit of them dare emails, as Matt sometimes says on Tuesdays, this week we're going to address one item, I think, from a couple weeks ago, and then we're going to start in with a topic that was given to us by our friend Fuzz over on the Discord channel. So first of all, a couple weeks ago when we were talking about the Scar and answering the question regarding the Scar as far as Sylvanas's face goes, Matt and I definitely talked about how it was caused by a non-magical weapon. Well, I was wrong. Perfectly fine with that, because I completely forgot that it was done by Charlemagne. It was done by Varian and Anduin's sword after it was given to Sarfang, or wielded by Sarfang. And that's just sort of one of those things, folks. Like, and while, you know, pointing it out to us, great, thanks, appreciate that. Remember, don't be mean about it. And also realize that Matt and I wind up having a lot of stuff that we try to remember on a regular basis, and sometimes things just slip. So we don't mind you keeping us honest, but yeah. So just so you know, the Scar was definitely caused not by Sarfang's axe, but by the magical sword once wielded by Varian Rin, now wielded by Anduin, which now is wielded by piloted drone Anduin. I don't know how to pronounce
honestly
it.
Honestly, don't know if that's the same weapon. I don't know. There's no way for us to know if he made a new weapon that looks like it or if they changed it. That's not, I mean, it looks like it probably changed, but also because I know someone's going to point this out, it was Thrall's axe.
Correct.
Thrall gave him the axe, and for all we know, it's a magic axe. I don't know. You know, there's no lore story about the axe yet, but who knows? But yeah.
Yeah, and again, sometimes we are going to forget things. It's just going to happen, so bear with us. But now that that's out of the way, we're going to be doing a little bit of something that I thought was actually kind of cool. Matt thought it was kind of cool, and it gives Matt an excuse to talk a whole heck of a lot more about Diablo, and it fits in with lore. So why not? Fuzz asked us, basically just said, I would love a Lore Watch episode or series on the lore behind the classes in Diablo. There's a ton of classes in Diablo. Some of them actually do have a lot of lore, but this is where I'm going to let Matt take it away and kind of talk about what he wants to talk about there.
I mean, there are a lot of classes, and some of them have like really deep story that I don't know everything about yet. For instance, Diablo Immortal is going to be establishing the lore of the Demon Hunters.
Oh, that's right.
We know that Demon Hunters exist. We know that they hunt demons. But in Diablo Immortal, you're going to see the kind of origins of the Order. You're going to see like the first Demon Hunters get together and start hunting demons. And it's not as simple as, you know, they don't just go out in the woods like with a pickup truck and some beer and cover themselves in demon urine. There's like a whole lot more to it. This is my stab at annoying all my friends from when I was a kid. I did a lot of hunting as a kid. But basically, I'm going to start with like some of the ones that are the easiest to talk about. Like, for instance, the barbarians and the druids are actually tight. They're very closely connected, because each group was founded by one of the Nephilim, the original Nephilim. The barbarians are founded by Bol'Kathos, obviously, and the druids were founded by a guy named Fiacla-Giar. Fiacla-Giar has got a few names, so you might have heard a different name for him, but the one I'm using is Fiacla-Giar. And the two of them were basically, they acted like they were brothers. I don't know if they actually were brothers. This is one of those situations where it's never been really clarified if they were descended from like a specific angel and demon, or if there's who their ancestors were, or if they were themselves directly related. But they behaved as if they were brothers. They did everything together. And as things went down with Anarius and the Worldstone, and the world was changing, the two of them realized that there was eventually the everything that they had happened with the angels and the demons and Lilith and all of that, there was going to be, the conflict was going to come to Sanctuary. They were like, no, this is not going to work. And they realized the Worldstone and the world of Sanctuary itself need to be protected, but how do we do that? How are we going to protect the world? And each of them had their own idea, and they couldn't come to an agreement on it. They were like, okay, well, we don't want to be like Linarion, and we don't want to be like Esu, who's the founder of the various mage clans. Was Esu. That was another Nephilim. We'll get to that. But they didn't want to do those things. They had their own ideas, but they couldn't come to an agreement. Like, how are we going to do this? So Fiacla-Giar was like, look, why don't we just, each of us will just do our own thing. We'll each try our approach and see if it works. And Bol'Kathos was like, all right, that makes sense to me. So they went to a group of people who lived in the north. And they lived in where is now the Dread Wastes, and what was at the time, you know, just, I forget what it was called actually before it became the Dread Wastes. But they lived there, and they said, okay, those of you who want to try Bol'Kathos' method, he's going to take you to
the
mountain.
Dread Lands?
Yes, thank you. It was the Dread Wastes now.
No, the Dread Wastes was, I thought that was Mists of Pandaria. I thought the Dread Lands was the Badlands, which was in the Northern Steppes, wasn't it? Am I misremembering?
It's your fault that I'm looking at this map now.
I'm fairly confident I remember it being the Northern Steppes before.
Okay, Dreadlands on my current map, so I'm going to go with Dreadlands. But that's the area where these people lived. I don't know what it was called before. I don't know what it was before it became the Dreadlands. I can't remember the name, unfortunately. I don't have an older map. Let's see if I can actually find the Diablo 2 map.
The internet says Northern Steppes, so it says I was right.
Okay. Here's the... Anyway, they got together, and they got a bunch of people together, and... Like I said, Bol'Kathos, you know, put out his offer, and he said, if you want to follow me in the direct defense of the Sacred Mountain, then come with me. And Fiacla-Giar was like, if you want to learn how to defend the entire natural world from things that are unnatural, then come with me. And the people split into two groups. One of them went north further with Bol'Kathos and became the Barbarians, the ancestors of the people we call the Barbarians. They obviously called themselves the children of Bol'Kathos. They didn't call themselves Barbarians. To them, they were the only civilized people because they were defending the Sacred Mountain. And the only people they recognized as kin were the Druids, who went over to Skazglen, which was across, I can't remember what that body of water is called, but it's the one where Z'Anzai is in. Skazglen was across that from what is now the Dreadlands. And The druids of Skazglen took up the teachings of Fiacla-Giar, who taught them how to tap into the natural world, how to, you know, do various druid magic, shapeshift, all that kind of thing. It's kind of like, if you look at the way the barbarians versus the druids work, it's like internal versus external changes. Like, the stuff that the barbarians do, it's all like they don't really change form. The closest they get is they get super huge. They get jacked up if they use the certain ancients' powers. Mm-hmm. But it's all about tapping into your ancestors and tapping into that kind of, you know, change that drives you. But it doesn't. You stay you. You're still you. You're just tapping into the inner self. You're tapping into the inner power. With the druids, it's about external change. They become things. They change shape. They become werebears and werewolves and summon natural forces. And it's that kind of the world versus the self split that the two brothers kind of exemplified. And that's the origin. That's the rough, bare bones origin of the two groups. We're going to find out more, obviously, in Diablo 4. And we should see a little bit more in Diablo Immortal, because we're going to see the barbarians basically stuck around Ariat and defended it for countless, you know, eons. They were there for, you know, all of recorded history throughout all of Sanctuary. Like, and people like Kandurus and Westmarch tried to conquer them repeatedly. They were trying to spread the religion of... Oh, bloody heck, I can't remember the name of this stupid religion. I'm going to feel so stupid when this finally pops into my head. I cannot remember the name of this bloody religion. Do you remember the name of the religion, Joe?
I do not, actually.
Oh, my heck. I'm going to have... No, I know. I even... You're going to have to talk while I look this up. When you had like figures like Rakkus, who is the founder of Westmarch, you know, he's the first king. He tried to conquer the barbarians to bring the Zakarum faith north and replace their ancestor worship, and he couldn't do it. Like they turned him repeatedly. Like every time he came up, he started off in Khajistan. He was like one of the people of that nation, and he founded Westmarch and brought his Zakarum faith to it. Basically to get him out of the way of the people who were actually in charge in Zakarum, in the Zakarum faith and in Khajistan, because they didn't want him to essentially lead a civil war in their country and fight for dominance. But it's really funny. Like I said, the barbarians turned everybody. It wasn't until Baal showed up and led basically every demon he could find, like north to Mount Ariat, that they finally failed. And unfortunately, their failure caused the corruption and then destruction of the Worldstone, which effectively destroyed their culture, because their sense of self, their culture, was built around defending Mount Ariat directly. It kind of looks like the druids had the better idea, if you're looking at the way the world is right now in Sanctuary, because the barbarians, their whole thing was defend this at all costs. And unfortunately, when you pay all costs and it's not enough, and now the Worldstone's gone, what happens? How do you defend Sanctuary now? Like, what are you defending it? What do you do? They're kind of like, some barbarian tribes are like, have descended into madness and started like going and turning into cannibal monsters. Like, I don't know if they're demon corrupted or not. I think we're going to see some of that in Diablo Immortal. We're going to see some of the effects of the pieces of the corrupted Worldstone, because that's the other problem. When the Worldstone got corrupted and then destroyed, the pieces of it rained down across all of Sanctuary, and they were all corrupted. So their demonic power is like, you know, Baal's power is infused through them, and they're being used by demons. I think that's the basic premise of Diablo Immortal, is that they're being used by demons to wreak untold havoc. And that's a thing we're going to see. I think we're going to see some of the barbarians just straight up falling to corruption. And we know that's established in Diablo 3 that happened, but we haven't seen it yet. And that's the actually interesting thing about Diablo Immortal, is a lot of stuff we're going to talk about in terms of the lore of these various groups, the classes and races and peoples of Sanctuary. That lore was established between Diablo 2 and 3, but we never saw it. Like, we saw the world like 20 years after. We didn't see all the stuff happening. Diablo Immortal, we're actually going to see it happening. So that's interesting to me. But as for the druids have spent all this time, you know, learning druid magic. We saw a druid character in Diablo 2 coming forth to defend the world, and we're going to see in Diablo 4, Diablo 4 is going to be set in Skazglen. So we're going to see what a place run by the druids is like. What the original, like, what have they done? What are their people like? What are their settlements like? That we're going to see. We're going to see what the druid nation itself is like, which we've never done before.
No, we haven't. And what's interesting about, like, the druids in particular to me is the fact of, one, where they're located. So Skazglen is, if you think of Diablo as having, like, I don't even know if I would, it's technically one continent, I think.
It's effectively split right down the middle.
But it's a
Sanctuary. Sanctuary has this body of water that is, it's a sea. It's called the Twin Seas.
Well, there's the Sea of Light at, I think it's the Southern Hemisphere, and then the Frozen Sea, which is the Northern Hemisphere.
But the Twin Seas goes right up between the two halves of Sanctuary. It divides the Dry Steppes and the Khajistan area from the mountains and Honduras and Westmarch.
Yeah, and so the interesting thing is, like Matt pointed out, like the barbarians, they make their home in one of the northernmost parts of that particular side of the continent. So above at Skazglen, there is this, like, the land is always is like this weird in between of like desert slash like tundra ish. Like with like the, if you've ever lived in a city or a place where like that in between of winter where there's not snow on the ground,
it's not buffalo,
no. But when you have like the dead trees almost, but like nature's still there and still present, that's almost what it comes across. Because just below them is the dry steppes, just below them that is Khajistan, which has Chaldeum, and it's roughly where they say that the Demon Hunter homeland is, or starting area is for Demon Hunters, where they call home in that area. And then just off to the northwest from where Skazglen is Jiansai, or I'm probably pronouncing that horribly wrong, but the homeland or island of the wizards, right? So, like, Druids are in this really interesting place where the land is not exactly lush and vibrant. It's a harsh land. Them being Druids seems to play into that because it's like they're almost tending to it and keeping that area just from the sheer power of their communication with nature. Druids have always been my favorite class in Diablo. Just because instead of using traditional magic, and instead of, you know, imposing their will on the world, they're sort of like the classic druid, right? Their magic is all based on their bond to nature. They have a kinship with the world of Sanctuary itself, which is interesting because they're one of the few, I think, classes that have a history of treating Sanctuary almost as a living, breathing entity of its own, which, as you know, we understand, it's a creation, right? So I think it's really interesting in that fact. The fact that they command not just the elements, but nature, or implore upon it to come to their aid, as well as different animal companions. And we talked about them being able to morph into, in this case, like, werebear and werewolf were the two forms from Diablo 2 that they were able to take. And the interesting thing to me is that it seemed to almost parallel a lot of the fighting styles that the barbarians had at the time, just way more literal. But I always absolutely adored them, and I'm interested to see more about their land. But it's especially because there's no urban centers, right? They're not a city place. I think they have one area. I think it's, what is it, like Tur Dalura, something like that, that's like in their general vicinity. It's a druid college of all places. And it has a giant oak tree, which is like super stereotypical druid thing. But like it just speaks to me as far as like, this is a really cool thing. And the druids were born from the barbarians, weren't they? Like they all had common ancestry.
Well, they, like I said, the same people, the Bulkathos and Fiaklagiar, came to them and said, "Okay, here's the deal. Here's what we're going to try and do. If you want to go with Bulkathos and defend the Worldstone, go ahead. And if not, come with me." And that's how they basically split up. They are effectively, I mean, they were at one point one people, and then they split up into two. They came from the area that's, you know, was called the Northern Steppes or the Wastes. See, I told you that was the Wastes, what have you. That area is where they originally come from, but some of them went to Skazglen with Fiaklagiar, and so they've lived there for a long time. It's essentially their home. They are from there. They've been there for a long time. Tur Dalura is essentially, like you said, it's where Fiaklagiar led them. It's the first place they settled. Most of Skazglen is the most it's villages. I think as of Diablo 4, the place is overrun by the Drowned.
Which is interesting because, like, the, what is it, Gloranfida? I can, again, my pronunciations are going to be absolutely atrocious, and I apologize. But that oak tree is, like, isn't it, like, a holy symbol for them? Like, it's a revered item or a revered entity to them as far as, like...
I think it's part of the... I think it's where they made their pact with Fiacla-Gaer. But the thing is that a lot of the stuff we have is... Like the history of the Druids going back to like it's basically just one little entry in the Diablo 2 book. So there's going to be a lot of stuff that I think will change and expand as we move into the thing.
Yeah.
I'm actually looking at the entry from the original, the Diablo handbook right now, because we actually have the book right here. So if you look at it, in the ancient tome of the Druids, the Sial Fada, and if you think his pronunciations are bad, I am deeply sorry. Mine are like, you know, but it's written that Bol-Kathos, the great and ancient king of the barbarian tribes, had a mysterious but trusted confidant who was only referred to as Fiacla-Gaer. This man is sometimes described as Bol-Kathos' closest friends, and other times he's referred to as his brother. So yeah, it was, they basically came together and they were like, well, here's my idea. And each of them thought, well, your idea is cool, but I want to do my idea, is how it ultimately works up. And the Druids actually have a name for what's going on right now. The whole thing with the attack of the demons on Sanctuary. It's, and I, you got me, man, how to pronounce this, but the Ulioshkada Mor, the final battle between the men of the world and the demons of the burning hells. And that's the thing that the two of them were preparing for.
And it almost seems like that fits in with what they're prepping for Diablo 4 as far as that goes and why the Druids are going to be involved in general, right?
Well, like, I mean, basically, if you played a Druid in Diablo 2 Lord of Destruction, you were fulfilling the terms of that prophecy because you're the first Druid to ever go back to Mount Ariat. The Druids, like, never returned. After they left, they never went back.
Well, that was a vow they took, right? Like, that they said that they wouldn't go back until the time, the final battle.
Yeah, exactly. It was part of that whole thing. It's like, we're not going back until the... And so that was the start of the final battle. Essentially, the past... Since then, from Diablo 2 to Diablo 4, that's been what's happening. This is the final battle, as far as they're concerned. And, yeah, the fact that the Drowned are, like, attacking Skazglen, that they're, like, they've overrun it, essentially, means that the Druids are extremely... We don't know yet exactly what's happening with the Druids, why they haven't stopped this. Like, maybe they can't. I don't know. Maybe they're, like, pushed too thin. We don't know what's going on, but, yeah, that's interesting. That's the storyline of the Druids is about to, like, come full circle, where, like, they've, instead of returning to defend the world against the demons, they seem to be incapable of defending their own territory. And we don't know what's going on with that.
Yeah. Didn't they, and this is going to maybe be an odd one, didn't the Druids also participate supposedly in the Mage Clan Wars?
Not exactly. They basically, that was the whole deal with Usa. I want to say Usa, but it might be Issu. But they effectively said, no, you don't bring your magic up here. They had a name for it. I can't remember the name. There it is. Dub Drolakia. Like, that's traditional magic. They were like, straight up, we're not dealing with your traditional magic. We're not part of this. Don't bring it up here. We're not going to get involved. The Mage Clan Wars took place mostly in Khajistan. And while the wizard is from Xian Sial, sorcery is not from Xian Sial. It's mm-hmm. from Khajistan. That's where Khajistan was started by wizards and sorcerers. And it was their magic that caused the Mage Clan Wars. That basically, when you're doing Diablo 3 and you're wandering around the desert and you see all that weird stuff, that's the leftovers from the Mage Clan Wars. They literally destroyed the area around them. I guess it's a good time that we should segue into talking about sorcerers and wizards and so forth.
Yeah.
There's a lot. A lot of this goes back to the Mage Clan Wars, and this is really complicated. I mentioned Esu. Esu is another one of the Nephilim, and one of the wizard clans, the Zan Esu, who are the ancestors of the sorcerers. The Zan Esu were like really big on understanding and controlling the elemental forces of the world, and they split into multiple clans, but the Zan Esu were one of the big ones. They basically fought over control of what was the biggest empire in the world at the time. And I want to say this is pre-Zakarum, but I'm not 100% on when the Zakarum actually started. Figuring out when the Zakarum started is not easy. Its origins are mysterious. It was definitely after the Zakarum started after what we call the Sin War, which is the battle where Odysseus and Keldroma discovered he was a Nephilim. And that whole bit with Inarius and the Legion, wrong franchise, guys. Inarius and Lilith and the angels and demons, basically, that whole bit where Lilith returned and attempted to return the Nephilim to power and depose Inarius as part of her plan to use the Nephilim to ultimately win the eternal conflict for herself. That was all way before the founding of the Zakarum. And we don't know exactly when, because the end of the Sin War erased the Sin War from existence.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when Odysseus did what he did, he reset the world so that none of the stuff that had led to him becoming a Nephilim had happened. He reset the World Stone so that it was no longer losing its power. And essentially, he sort of sacrificed himself and became like a god at the same time. It's hard to explain exactly what happened with that, but I don't know if I should talk about the Zakarum and the Paladins and the Crusaders here, or if I should talk about the Mage Clan Wars. But when the Zanesu were formed, they were following Nessu's footsteps, and that meant that magic amongst the Mage Clans became codified, and the codification was based around the elemental magics. Like, if you look at the original Diablo and the Sorcerer, or the Sorcerers from Diablo 2, you'll notice their powers are very elemental-based.
Well, wasn't that also born part of their vow or pact never to summon demons or do any more demonic magic, or at least a couple of them? I think it was, there were three mage clans, I think, right?
I think there were more than three originally. But
three big ones, the three major ones, right? Because I remember, I think it was the Aeneid and the Amuet were the ones that said that no mage should ever summon another demon into Sanctuary, and like focused and started shifting their magic focus into more of the elements.
Yeah, originally there were apparently seven, there were seven major and seven minor clans originally. But the ones we know about, the Vizirai, the Aeneid, and the Amunult, those are the three that are the biggest, the most famous. The Tan and Zanesu clans are both powerful now. They weren't always historically so. It's interesting because the Zanesu are based around the teachings of Esu,
mm-hmm.
who was, like I said, that ancient Nephilim. But the Zanesu aren't. They're one of the oldest of the clans, but they were very secretive for a very long time. And so as a result, they didn't. Basically, the Mage Clan Wars, they didn't take part. They were like, no, we have nothing to do with this ridiculousness. Because the Mage Clan Wars were basically caused by people summoning demons. That's, in fact, the big problem with a lot of this, is trying to figure out exactly when it happened. The Mage Clan Wars almost certainly happened after Odysseus. Because before Odysseus, the Burning Hells had not actually found Sanctuary yet.
Yeah,
So there were no pacts to be had.
Yeah, and I think they said that it was like the decades that followed the events of the Sin War.
Yeah.
But because time got weird, it's a little hard to pinpoint.
Yeah, because of the reset, but Isu, you know, we'll go back to Isu for a minute here and try and explain. Like, the ancients, when you hear the idea of the ancients are the Nephilim who were around in the beginning. And you've Bul-Kathus, Esu, Fiaclagiar, Linarion, a.k.a. Rathma, and some others. There's ones we don't like. There's the one that founded the Skothos, and the Amazons were descended from, and we'll get to that. But they were the original first generation of Nephilim. The ancients were the ones who were first born from the angels and the demons in Sanctuary. And Esu was the one who was kind of like, was really about the elements themselves, the natural world. Because Sanctuary is a world that has its own nature. It has its own. It's not like, if you look at the places where the angels and the demons come from, those are planes, they're shaped by kind of conception. They're shaped by the nature of the existence of the beings that live there. The angels are all born out of the crystal arch. The demons are all born out of the blasted carcass of Tathamet. Like, they're like maggots in the carcass. And, you know, the Pandemonium planes, the fields of Pandemonium, are shifting between those two powers as they continuously war on them. There's no set reality to that place. It changes constantly. The Worldstone made Sanctuary as a place that endures. It has its own natural world. It's much as Bul-Kathus drew power from the idea of, like, you know, overcoming and dominating the world, and Fiaclagiar drew power from understanding the world, and the Esu was the components of the world.
The elemental nature, essentially, of the world.
The things that made the world up. The idea of Esu basically went out and meditated on the powers of the storm, like of earth, fire, and water, and by meditating, understood how to control them. And with Esu's magic, Esu basically invented the magic the way that mortals could use it. Before, you know, Esu, the ancients, the Nephilim, could control the world by the sheer power of their, you know, their connection to both, you know, good and evil. The primordial Anu that was both in one, the Nephilim had that kind of power. But Esu managed to create a kind of magic that mortals could use, that humans could use. And the Zanisu clan are the sorceresses that you see in Diablo 2 and probably Diablo 4, though we don't know yet for sure. They use her follow. They follow her teachings. Not all the mage clans follow her teachings. And in fact, the ones that Joe just mentioned, a lot of them summon demons. They basically took the way that Esu invented, the magic that Esu invented, they took it and learned different ways to use it. For instance, the wizard that you play in Diablo 3 is from Xiancel, as Joe mentioned, and he or she came south to study with the mage clans, but ultimately rejected their teachings. And you'll notice the wizard does different things. Some of it's similar. Like I believe that they have like a blizzard type spell, ice storm or what have you. I don't play a wizard very often. But a lot, you'll notice the disintegrate spell and the arcane missiles that they fling off. It's a different kind of magic. It's basically just saying, I'm just going to use raw magical power. I'm not even going to waste time manipulating the elements with it. I'm just going to throw magic at you. And each school of magic that rose, each mage clan had their own approach to how they were using magic. They took what Esu had originally established and went off in their own directions with it. During the Sin War, they existed. Their mage clans existed during the Sin War, and they thought that the druids and necromancers were essentially offshoots of their kind of school of magic. I think that's what you were talking about earlier, Joe.
Yeah, so like they're basically viewed as, from the mage's perspective, at least from what I can remember, you are calling to nature. You're doing this. You're just like us and our elements. And the druids are just like, no, we're nothing like you. We're not dominating the world. We're asking the world. We're in tune with it. We're not trying to manipulate it in an unnatural way. And then you have the necromancers or the priests of Rathma, who they're like, oh, you can use arcane power to make these automatons move. And they're like, no, we're about balance. We're not about dominating or making things go to our whim. Like, we do this because we have to, and this is how we maintain order. But so it was interesting because, like, mages were trying to find common ground. And I think during the Mage Clan Wars, they were actually, like, approached as, hey, come join us and help us win. Which is, like, I'm being very, very, boiling it down to the base components. And pretty much both were just like, nah, we're good. We got our own stuff to deal with. And we don't want anything to do with what you're doing. And you can hear some of that, too, with, like, if you play a wizard in Diablo 3 and you come across the NPC necromancer, there is some, I don't want to say it's like, it's not exhaustive dialogue, but the reaction is slightly different, right? Like, there's almost like a revulsion, which I think is really fascinating. And I'm wondering how that's going to play into the future, especially with Diablo 4 and what role the necromancers might play in that moving forward. But yeah.
Yeah. The deal with the Vizjarai in particular, as Joe pointed out, the various mage clans discovered demon summoning. They discovered the means to do it. And this is part of the whole deal where Aldissian ultimately reset the world. The Vizjarai caused the Triune Cult, which you've heard of if you've played Diablo 3, the Triune Cult has returned. The Triune Cult was basically a cult that worshipped the three primevals. They worshipped Diablo, Baal, and Mephisto under different names as gods.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped cause the Sin War, because it was the Triune versus Inarius that originally created the problems that Aldissian was responding to. But as a result of that, that was how was because the Viserai had learned how to summon demons, and they said they didn't. The thing is they didn't ban summoning demons. They banned telling people about summoning demons. They said this has to stay secret. We have to keep this lore of demon summoning to ourselves, because if other people knew about it, they wouldn't understand. And the Viserai kept summoning demons and kept, you know, making deals with them. And it was that's how the Primevals originally found out about Sanctuary. That's how the Sin War happened in the first place. And after that, that's when the Mage Clan said, okay, you can't, like the other two, I was just looking at their names, the Ennead and the, I can't remember the other one.
Amulet.
Yeah, they were like, okay, you can't summon demons anymore. Nobody can summon demons anymore. The world was almost destroyed. We got to stop doing that. And so the concept of what actually happened during the Sin War, everybody knew something bad had happened. Nobody knew what. Like think about how this affected the Mage Clans. Like they didn't know what had happened, but they knew that blind faith and religion had not stopped it. They knew that the various religions at the world at that time, and this is before the Zakarum faith existed. They were like, okay, we got to stop doing that. But we'll try reason. We'll try, you know, using the stuff that we used to get to be mages in the first place. We'll use that to control the world, and we'll run the new empire Kedjistan based on those principles. And it didn't really work out, because the Viserai were like constantly at odds with the other two mage clans for power over the nation, and they couldn't win without summoning demons.
Well, the other thing that I think should be also like mentioned here is that demon summoning was an accident originally too. Like it wasn't what they had originally set out to do, which I think is fascinating. There was this belief that spirits sort of like existed in Sanctuary and outside of Sanctuary, and what those spirits were was sort of in question, and that if you tried hard enough and studied hard enough and used your magic, you could actually make contact with them, right?
And that's actually it's the whole deal of the thinking the druids and the necromancers were like them. They were like, okay, well, they can talk to spirits, so we'll copy what they do. And the Viserai sorcerer Jerry Harash is actually responsible for this. And he was trying to replicate what he'd seen druids and necromancers do, and instead he reached the Burning Hells.
Yeah.
And that again started the whole Sin War and everything. But sure, that was accidental, but that was like at this point that was hundreds of years
ago. Oh yeah, I just thought it was something to throw out there that like it wasn't demon summoning wasn't the original intent. It just sort of became the thing.
But it basically was born out of the sorcerer's insistence that everybody who did anything that wasn't like, you know, just picking up an axe was secretly a wizard. They were like, everyone's a sorcerer like us. Everybody's using magic like us. It was their attempt to replicate what those people were doing without understanding the tradition that they were drawing from that led them to summoning demons, because they couldn't do what druids do. Druids can talk to the natural world. Necromancers are disciples of Tragul, the dragon of the balance. The mage clans did not have that, and so could not do it. And what ended up happening was, as those three clans were fighting for power over the empire of the Kedjistan, they were, like I said, the Viserai couldn't dominate without demon summoning. So they began summoning demons again to use them to subdue the others. And what happened was, essentially, this was proved that the Viserai were summoning demons, even though they had said that they wouldn't do it. The other two clans, the Ennead and Amulet, sent assassins, and the assassins we'll come back to because that's another class. I don't think we've got time in this entire episode for every class.
No, this is probably going to be a multi-episode thing if we.
But they hired an assassin clan to go kill the Viserai who were summoning demons, and the Viserai were like, "Oh, you're killing our people. Oh, that's how you want to do this. Okay, we'll hire assassins." And so they started hiring assassins to go kill the other members of the other mage clans. And the mage clan war basically erupted out of this conflict between these various groups. Now, I mentioned the Tan and the Zanisu. The Tan and the Zanisu weren't involved in this mage clan war because they weren't the ones trying to dominate the empire. The Viserai were going to get wiped out, and they were losing the war. And so they basically went, all right, F it. And they started summoning tons of demons, just constantly summoning them. And this led to the city of Vizjun being wiped out. It got blown off the face of the world. So many demons were summoned and so many died. And there was like even like the wizards on the other side of the Mage Clan War. And the word wizard and sorcerer are kind of synonymous here.
Yeah, I was going to say they're almost interchangeable. It's just mostly a difference of philosophy.
But when the Mage Clan War finally ended, it ended when, like, for instance, the figure Bartok, who's kind of always, he's also known as the Warlord of Blood, and you know he was the most powerful member of the Vizjarai Clan. His demons got turned on him; they were turned against him, and you know, the whole thing was just a mess. And at the end of it, after the destruction of Vizjun, the mages just weren't loved in their homeland anymore, because why would they? The Vizjarai were like, F it, we're not summoning anything ever again. Like, nope, no more summoning. You can't summon anything. And they formed a secret police within the clan that would hunt them down if they tried doing it. And the Age of Magic essentially ended. It was the people of Khajistan were like, they basically looted the Mage Clan holdings. They destroyed everything that they had. They left one place that because they couldn't get to it. I'm trying to remember. I think it was the Ishari Sanctum. Yeah, the Ishari Sanctum is the one place they didn't go to, because everything else, all the libraries, all the tomes of the Mage Clans were destroyed. Their holdings were destroyed. Only the like isolated Mage Clans like the Tan and the Zanesu were left untouched. And the power of sorcerers over Khajistan was broken. Like, that's the end of their dominance for untold centuries, until fairly recently. The Trade Consortium of Chaldeum, after the Dark Neotristum, after the Dark Wanderer, the Chaldeum became the capital of Khajistan. It wasn't for the longest time, but it became so when the Dark Wanderer came through and just utterly messed everything up. Because Chaldeum was the trade hub. But it was originally Karast that was the you know, most important city, and it was the capital city. Karast was the capital city of Khajistan up until Diablo II, which is when the Dark Wanderer wanders through Karast on his way to Mephisto's imprisonment. Chaldeum, when it said, okay, we're the capital now, and we run Khajistan now, Chaldeum basically reached out to the Mage Clans and was like, we need help. And so since the Zakharum faith, which had run the empire for centuries, was now in disorder. It was just basically destroyed by Mephisto's release. They reached out to the Mage Clans, and the Mage Clans were like, all right, we'll back you. But in return, we get a position of more importance. And it's kind of like the Sanctum, the Sanctum of the Mages, the Ishari Sanctum, it's in Chaldeum. So that's one of the reasons that the nation of Chaldeum reached out to it, the city of Chaldeum, sorry. And because of that, I'm trying to think of how to explain this. Basically, what you get in Chaldeum is there are like three ages of Khajistan. There's the Age of Magic in Khajistan, which is the one we just talked about, where it was ultimately fell apart because of the Mage Clan Wars. Then there's the Age of Faith, where the Zakharum Church became the power and ran the empire for, you know, thousands of years. And then when that fell apart due to Mephisto and Baal and Diablo, the Mage Clans in Chaldeum basically became the Age of Trade. And for 20 years or so, that's what was going on. But now we don't really know yet what happened between Diablo 3 and Diablo 4, because Diablo 4 hasn't come out yet. We do know that whatever Malthiel was doing, it killed a lot of people. Like, I think at one point they said like 9 out of 10 died. And I don't know if that's actually the canon going into the game, or if that's just somebody like pulling a number out of their head while talking about it. But enough people died that at this point in Diablo 4, it seems that Khajistan is not a nation anymore. Like, there's no central authority. It feels like the Mage Clans may finally be gone, that there's nobody to hold Khajistan together, and it is falling apart. But the wizard class that you see in Diablo 3 are students from the Ishari Sanctum that have left. They've actually started their own tradition. they've basically abandoned the mage clans. Most people from mage clans are what you'd call sorcerers. The sorceress from Diablo 2 is on the Zan Esu clan, who was obviously never involved in the Ishari Sanctum, never involved in the mage clan wars. The Zan Esu have been minding their own business and pursuing pure elemental magic for untold centuries. And that's the sorcerer you see in Diablo 2 and probably in Diablo 4. It's almost certainly the same class. The sorcerer from Diablo 1, we have no idea where that guy's from. We don't know what clan he's from. We don't know if he's from a clan at all. We don't know what the deal is with that guy. We just know that he was a sorcerer. He could have learned magic from he could have been one of the Haradrim, because that's the other competing magical tradition, which is born out of the mage clans. It's born out of that same tradition, is the Haradrim. But the Haradrim are also inspired by a specific being. And then they're not really a class in Diablo, but it's important to know about the Haradrim. So I feel like we should do a little bit of a sidetrack here.
Yeah, and I think it fits too, because like there is some crossbleed between, like, even with the mages, like the Viz Jaktar. I'm, again, pronunciation not going to be a strong suit here. I think they were mentioned in the Book of Cain in particular, in like as a parallel to the Haradrim in general. So yeah, the Haradrim probably is a good sidetrack as far as
when the Sin War happened, and after it, and then the Mage Clan Wars happened, and so forth. Tyriel was concerned with what was going on in Sanctuary, because he realized that the big three, Diablo, Baal, and Mephisto, couldn't be trusted. You couldn't have a pact with them. When Heaven and Hell came up with their pact of non-interference in Sanctuary, he knew that was basically like waving a red flag in front of a bull. It was like, they're going to interfere. That they're, in fact, the whole idea of them making a pact is ridiculous. They by nature, they cannot keep their word. Like, they will keep the word of what they've pledged to the letter, but they will immediately find a way to twist it so that they can get what they want. That's their nature. They corrupt things. They're not trustworthy. You cannot trust them. You can only trust them to be deceptive and deceitful, because that's their nature. So he decided, okay, I need to come up with a way to defend Sanctuary that, strictly speaking, doesn't violate the pact. Because I'm an angel, I can't do that. And what he came up with was, well, if I there's nothing in the pact that says I can't talk to them. It just says I can't go, I can't do anything on Sanctuary. I can't take action, but I can talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
So he found a group of various mages who'd seen the devastation caused by the Mage Clan War and the demon summoning and all that. And he said, okay, bad things are coming. The primevals are going to come up with a way to get onto Sanctuary. I'm going to teach you a way to confine them. And it was, he gave them the knowledge of soul stones, which required them to get pieces of the world stone. And that, keep in mind, the world stone had been defended by the barbarians. We talked about that earlier, had been defended by the barbarians for like literal centuries. Rakhis had led armies north to try and conquer the barbarians and had failed. But there were still some pieces of the world stone available, because the world stone had been in Pandemonium for eons before it was brought to Sanctuary, before Sanctuary was created with it. And the various angels and demons had taken pieces away from it. So here's where Tyriel essentially cheats, because he gives them pieces of the world stone. That's pretty close to straight up interference.
Yeah.
But he does it. I'm not sure if he gives them to them or just tells them where they can find them. Like, I don't know if he knows that Inarius had pieces. I mean, Inarius was studying the world stone for eons. The Nephilim studied the world stone. I'm sure that there were pieces to be had. I don't know exactly how that worked, but he taught them how to use those pieces to create the soul stones. And the soul stones could trap the various demons that they were keyed to. One particular member of the Haradrim, a guy named Zoltan Kuhl, however, was smarter than Tyriel realized. And looking at what Tyriel had taught them, the first thing he realized was that, yeah, these things will confine demons, but I could make one that could confine anything. How come he hasn't told us how to do that? What's he hiding? And he came to realize that the angels didn't like Sanctuary or the people of Sanctuary much better than the demons did. He found out about the Sin War, for one thing. In the process of doing this, he awakened to his own Nephilim nature. you'll notice that in Diablo 3, he's constantly calling the Nephilim a peer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a similar situation. He understood what he was. He understood that all humans were ultimately, you know, the result of the Nephilim's creation, that it was in every human the potential to become a Nephilim that led to all these weird magical powers and abilities on Sanctuary. The reason that mortals could use magic at all was that piece of the truly divine, the piece of the original primordial Anu that resides in each and every one of us. And so Zoltan Kul created what he would call the Black Soulstone. And as a result of that, the Haradrim hunted him down, couldn't kill him. And so they took all the blood out of his body, cut his head off and his body into pieces.
And banished him to the Shadow Realm.
Yeah. So they did as much as they could to punish him for making the Black Soulstone. But regardless, the three Soulstones were still in use. They broke up into three groups, and the original leader of the Haradrim, a wizard named Tal Rasha, went after Mephisto. No, was it Mephisto or Baal? No, it was Baal.
Baal.
He went after Baal. Another group went after Mephisto, and a third group led by an ancestor of Deckard Cain, I think his name was Torad Cain, but I can't ever remember what the original one's name was, went after Diablo. Diablo and Mephisto were captured and put in the Soulstones, but Tal Rasha's group, the Soulstone got broken because Baal is the Lord of Destruction. He destroyed it. And so lacking a second, they didn't have Zoltan Kul to make another Soulstone for them. Lacking another option, they imprisoned Baal inside Tal Rasha. This was Tal Rasha's idea, proving amongst other things that everybody keeps having this idea of putting demon lords inside them.
Yeah, I don't know why they think this is a good idea.
It ends up not working out too well. But Tal Rasha, using the pieces of the soul stone that was broken, manages to confine Baal within his body and is then locked in a tomb underneath, oh, bloody heck, I can't remember the name of the city he was under, but El Alamon, is that it?
Possibly. I'll look it up while you're talking.
Yeah, but they can find him in a tomb underneath the city. And as for Diablo and Mephisto, Mephisto is actually taken to the sacred city next to Karast, and I cannot remember it, but it's right across the way from Karast. It's right there. And he's imprisoned in what was the brand new Zakharum Holy Temple, and the priests of the Zakharum are entrusted with watching over that soulstone. The third soulstone was taken out to a tiny little monastery and it wasn't a Zakharum monastery. It was actually a Haradrim monastery at the time, and buried underneath that, figuring, okay, nobody knows where this place is, so it's a good place to hide him. And I mean, this worked for a while. The three evils were confined for a significant chunk of time. Unfortunately, almost all of it was banana pants. And as a result of the confinement of Mephisto, the Zakharum faith now had a demon lord who of lies and deception buried underneath its sacredest place. And he started reaching out. He couldn't, like, he was trapped in the soulstone. He couldn't go anywhere. He couldn't do anything, but he could talk. And unfortunately, Mephisto's really good at talking.
Yeah. And that's sort of like the great flaw of the soulstones, right? And this is something that we've learned that nobody's perfected. Even Zoltan Kul, who was arguably probably the most powerful of the mages at the time,
the most expert at soulstones. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like you could imprison something within it, but by the very nature of the soulstones, and I don't know if this is just an oversight, but again, soulstones were part of the world stone. The world stone mm-hmm. created sanctuary. So if you put something inside of something that made the world you're trying to protect, great, powerful things might still have a way to influence the world around them. It's like, it's one of those weird moments of why did nobody think of this?
I think it's to a certain degree, it feels like the soulstones were a stopgap, because keep in mind that Tyriel was working entirely by himself.
Yeah.
He didn't have access to the other angels. He couldn't even tell them what he was doing, because if he did, they'd be like, you know, he'd be dragged in front of Imperius for betraying the pact. Because keep in mind that the angels don't care what happens to Sanctuary at all. They don't want the demons to have it because they don't want them to use it as a farm for eternal, you know, if they could corrupt the entire world of Sanctuary, they could basically just keep throwing Sanctuary things at the angels until the angels are softened up and then come at the angels in their full force. That's what the angels are afraid of, but they don't care about Sanctuary. They'd sooner see it destroyed than deal with the problem. So the non-interference pact was basically a compromise, because Imperius couldn't get the votes to wipe out Sanctuary, but he sure as heck wasn't going to put himself out, and Malthiel wasn't making any decisions. As the swing vote, Malthiel could have decided, okay, no, I back Imperius, but he didn't. And as a result of Malthiel not backing him and Tyriel not backing him, the world didn't get destroyed. But there was no consensus on the Angeras Council to defend Sanctuary. So Tyriel had no backup. And the Haradrim, which was his creation, was his attempt to do it. It was his attempt to create a defense for Sanctuary against the Primevals.
Yeah, which makes sense. And it was, when your back is against the wall, any defense is better than no defense, right? And that's really what sort of the situation was. But I think I don't know if we want to pull it to a close for today and go back into some of the classes, because while we've talked about mages and the legacy of Zoltan Kuhl, talking about the Haradrim and their interaction with it as a result of it, I think we can call it for today and come back next week and start talking about the Assassin Order, how they were created, their involvement in Diablo 2 and coming to light. And I think
I want to say this much. Yeah. The sorcerers are the original deal in terms of arcane casters on Sanctuary. Wizards are a recent version of them.
Mm-hmm.
If you call yourself a wizard, you're basically somebody who's had training at the Shari Sanctum, but who decided, no, this is dumb, and went off into the world. And it's sort of like a generational thing, where if you're a wizard, you're basically just a sorcerer. You're just a sorcerer who's doing it slightly differently and using different magics. But it is essentially the sorcerer from Diablo, the sorcerers from Diablo 2, the wizard from Diablo 3, and the sorcerers from Diablo 4 are all basically following the same tradition. They're doing it differently, but they're all related. And I think that that's the real takeaway here. It's just different words for the same basic idea.
Yeah, more or less. But I think that's going to do it for our episode today. Thank you very much, Fuzz, for that wonderful gift that's going to keep on giving, because I think it has been a long time since we really dedicated any sort of length of time to Diablo, and I think it's time that maybe we actually do give it some leeway or some time in the sun, especially with Diablo Immortal on the horizon and Diablo 4 in the future. But Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/BlizzardWatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And again, thank you very much. If you do have questions for the show, please send them in. We will be gathering them up for when we're done with this run of episodes or interspersed in between. Haven't decided yet. We're going to figure out how that's going to work. But send them into podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Again, singular. Or if you are a Patreon supporter, you can go to our Discord channel, set aside specifically for Patreon supporters. It's podcasting Q questions. If you don't have Patreon, don't want to send us an email, but you're still in the Discord, we do have a Q questions section on the Discord where you can go ahead and ask us questions for the podcast as well. As always, just specify which podcast they're for so that Matt and I can conserve our energy for those mud fights that we have to have between each episode for those questions. Matt, anything else you want to add before we part ways for the evening?
One thing I will mention is that the Assassin Order existed before the Mage Clan Wars, but it's the Mage Clan Wars that made them as big as they ended up being.
That is very true. And we're going to talk about that more in the next episode. So thank you very much. We'll see you next week.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.